broadcasting from the University City.
We are Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It's fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour. We are here to keep you up to date with Cambridge's food and drink scene, and I'd love opening to David Bowie. Thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. And today, how two Cambridge foodies hit the TV screens, kitchen gadgets that our reviewer Tina Roche thinks aren't worth the bother.
I visit a new cafe in Mill Road, a rather different cafe, this one. And if you fancy growing your own food this year, Dave Fox will be talking about the value of composting. Throughout the programme, we'll be keeping an eye out on Twitter and Olio to see what's going on right now. And Emer O'Hanlon will be talking about what food and drink activities are coming up at the Cambridge University.
And after that, we'll have city news. But to begin with, the first of two stories about how being a Cambridge foodie has led to being on television. If you've eaten in a Cambridge restaurant or with a street food trader in Cambridge and you didn't see Ozzie Beck, it will be because you've just missed him. He will have been there. And soon he'll be on BBC TV in a show called Yes, Chef. I spoke to him shortly before filming took place and he explained what the programme involves and how he got to be on it.
Yes, Chef is a cookery contest on the BBC and was broadcast last year. In summer, it's in the afternoon, so probably not that many people have seen it. But I was on during a time when I was at home recovering from my accident, so I randomly came across it. And basically, the first 4 days, you get four contestants. They are cooking for a guest chef. It will be sort of a well-known professional chef. There are three challenges on the first day. The first is you're cooking a signature dish, so that's completely up to you what you want to cook, but you need to hand in the recipe beforehand. And then there is a technical challenge set by the guest chef, which was when I was watching the series last year, was really varied. It was something really, really simple, like mushrooms on toast, or it could have been something rather technical, like filleting a fish and then cooking the fish. It's a bit of luck of a draw what happens then. After that challenge, one contestant is eliminated. And then you get the third challenge, which is a bit like the mystery box on MasterChef. So you get a tray of ingredients, and so you don't know what you're getting beforehand. That is a complete surprise. And then you have, I think it's an hour to cook something with at least one ingredient on the tray, but ideally with all of them. It's called the chef's special. And then the chef will cook a dish, basically what he had in mind when he put those ingredients together. And then after that, you will have a winner of the day. And so you get four heat winners, who will then cook with the chef they were cooked for previously. They build a team, and there are two challenges on the final day. And these are judged by Pierre Coffman, well-known French chef who has been active in London for a long time until he retired earlier this year. There's, again, two challenges. The first is recreate the dish, it's called. Professional chef shows you the dish, the whole process.
What, the making of it?
The making of it.
Yeah.
You can take notes and all of that, and then you need to cook it yourself while the chef is watching. They then have, during that time, 2 minutes where they can intervene. When they're sitting in a separate room and watching this on a screen, And when they notice, hang on, he's forgotten something or is doing something not right, then they can sort of intervene and make it right so you can actually finish. And then the second challenge is you're given two ingredients by Pierre Kaufman, and you're working together with your chef, and you are then need to cook two courses incorporating those two ingredients.
So are you given free range as to what other ingredients you can use?
For the challenges, yes. Yeah. There will be a larder, sort of a simple thing. But you need to, for the first chef specials, you need to use at least one ingredient.
So how do you feel about it?
Slowly getting a bit anxious. But I applied for it because watching it, I thought that was something I could do. It's definitely not at the level of, for example, MasterChef is. It's most of the people applied there are sort of the average home cooks. And I think I can run along with that.
Yeah, but are you doing any preparation?
Unfortunately, what I'm cooking is a dish I've been cooking a few times. I'm cooking hake with ratatouille and chorizo. And I cooked something similar on Saturday. Just didn't have any hake, but I had monkfish, so which works a bit taste-wise is similar. And just to make sure that, yeah, I can still do this.
You're not doing any preparation as far as general techniques are concerned?
Not really, because I do cook all the time, really. And also, yeah, I don't know what the technical challenge will be. It could be something I'm not familiar with at all, so, yeah, because I don't have the time.
Yeah. When's it going to be on television?
I assume it'll be the same, round about the same time as last year, which was in August.
Oh, gosh, they're doing it a long time in advance, then.
It's always a long time. Yeah. They have quite a bit of lead. When you watch something like MasterChef, the ingredients they're using are always out of season because it's been at least half a year in between filming and the actual broadcast.
So on the sort of the final day, if you get through to the final day, but presumably there's a winner from the final
Yes.
day.
Yes, and then you basically get from those two challenges, you get the point score, and whoever has the most points then wins the week.
And if you win the week, is there another?
No, stage? It's just no, right. No. It's basically there are no semifinals or finals or whatever. It's just the week.
Yeah.
So by the end of the season, there will be, I think it's 5 weeks, so there will be five winners of Yes Chef for that year.
How did they choose you? Because they must have quite a few applicants.
So when you send in the application, they then send you a questionnaire where you answer questions, most of them quite generic, sort of, you know, what is your cooking style, what type of food, what type of cuisines do you prefer? Even asked me, one of the questions was, who my favourite chef is?
And who is your favourite chef?
And obviously said Mark Poynton of Alimentum. it had to be the local one. That was a few weeks later. I got a phone call from one of the producers, and they had, and he again asked me similar questions and a few more specific things as well, again about cooking and about cooking, you know, availability. Obviously, I have a non-disclosure agreement I have to sign, so I won't be able to talk about anything that happened during the recording until it's been broadcast.
How frustrating.
Which will be sometime in August,
yeah.
I assume.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you'll get things like expenses, but do you actually get paid as well?
No, don't get paid, but I get travel is expended and stay at hotel is expended, and then, yeah, anything, yeah, other expenses as well.
And it's filmed...
It's in Manchester, near
Stockport.
Near Stockport. It's at the Cheshire Cookery School.
Right, right. Well, I hope it goes well. Aussie.
Thank you very much.
We'll be rooting for you.
Yep, thank you.
Thank you.
Aussie Beck there, and Yes Chef will be on our screens around about August, so we'll keep you posted. But talking about TV chefs, how often do you see them using a gadget, say like a lemon squeezer, or a stuffed burger press, or a citrus zinger infusion pack? Well, I asked Tina Roche of the Cambridge Cookery School and Cafe what she thought of some gadgets that are currently on the market.
Matt, you asked me if I felt that some of these utensils on your list were my favourite tools, and they include a hand-powered food chopper, a lattice pie crust cutter, a garlic grinder, a dial-dated food storage container, some herb scissors, and a Bluetooth thermometer, which sends an alert, apparently, this is new to me, to one's iPhone to tell you when your meat has reached the optimal internal temperature. So I asked you if we could turn this around 180 degrees, and I could give you my reasons for why I wouldn't consider these essential. And I'm not really a gadget person anyway, but I think a food chopper, well, yes, but I think most people have at least one half-decent knife in their kitchen drawer. And I think it's better to learn how to handle your knives properly and feel that you're kind of in control of one good chef's knife. People often ask us what to buy, and I think all you need is one large chef's knife that sits well in your hand, and some shops will offer you something like a zucchini or whatever to try and chop is important. It's like trying on a pair of shoes. It needs to fit you. So I think once you have a good knife, that's your trusted tool. And a lattice pie crust cutter with a sort of stencil effect, well, I think probably not. I would just use one of those little pastry wheels or even a pizza wheel and cut with that. A garlic grinder. So you see here, we don't even have garlic presses. Most professional kitchens would make a puree using the very tip of their knife, like a little bird's beak, mincing it down with sea salt, which acts as an abrasive. So you end up, after about 2 minutes, with a garlic paste that is a bit salty, but it's lovely and smooth and quite wet. And the benefits of cooking with that are, one, it doesn't tend to burn, like garlic always does. It burns very quickly because salt brings out liquids. It stops your garlic from burning if that's going in the pan before other things. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it distributes very well through the food, unlike chopped garlic that sits often like little half-burnt pieces. So that's definitely our preferred method, is to mince garlic by hand. And then the dial-dated food storage, well, I don't know, it sounds to me that is yet another sort of annoying thing that takes up fridge space. So I would just write with a felt tip pen on my plastic bags and make sure that you don't forget your lovely leftovers and you actually go for them and eat them the next day or the day after. Herb scissors, I don't know. Nail scissors, large scissors, I think any any set of scissors would probably be capable of cutting your herbs. And the final one, the Bluetooth thermometer that speaks to your iPhone, that makes me think of that wonderful sketch about the electric toothbrush, you know, and everything that it can do, and it only costs you £200. I think a lot of what we teach here is how you can gauge when something is done, a piece of steak, a piece of chicken, even fish, by touch, and to some degree smell and eyesight as well. But the best thing is to learn that you can probe something, and if it feels very, very gelatinous and soft, it's generally undercooked, particularly if it's a fish, and steak would be very, very rare at that point. When it's squidgy, kind of in between very soft and very firm, it's usually just right. When it starts to feel very hard and rigid, like the sole of a well-beaten boot, it's ready for the bin, you know, it's overcooked, you pass the point of no return. And learning how to gauge that squidginess, I think, is much better. And then you really trust, you don't need any tools. You know yourself when something is cooked. Obviously, that goes for smaller pieces. And I think you can just turn to a good recipe online or your trusted cookery book when it comes to big joints and so on, for timings, etc. But for smaller pan-fried pieces on a daily basis, just prod a little and you'll know.
That was Tina Roche there from the Cambridge Cookery School on Hills Road. They offer plenty of courses for all ages and skills, as well as wine tastings and a restaurant. You can even go truffle hunting in the Mediterranean with them if you fancy. A full rundown is on their website, cambridgecookeryschool.com.
Listen to Cambridge 105 on Radio Player at cambridge105.fm. There's also free apps available for Google, Apple, Kindle Fire and Windows devices, making listening on the go through your smartphone or tablet easy. Stream powered by LoHo for all your internet service and telephony needs.
And here's our second television-related story. Jo Christie, better known as Miss Soufflé, is a very popular local blogger who also does a nice line in afternoon teas. And here is Jo speaking with Dr. Sue Bailey about her blog and what it led to and how blogging was a complete accident in the first place.
Well, it's so funny. So in about 2009, I was very, very bored. I literally was bored of going home every day after work and sitting watching the telly. So I googled how do I challenge myself, and I came across lots of bloggers. Long story short, a lot of pop-up afternoon tea events in London. And at the time, there wasn't really a very exciting food scene in Cambridge. So I decided to almost copy what was going on in London and bring it to Cambridge. Then I brought it to Cambridge. All the other pop-up supper club hosts were blogging alongside it. That was the way of advertising their supper club. So I figured that was what I had to do. So I started a blog, and literally I looked back the other day and my first blog post literally said, "Hi, if you're out there reading this, thank you. This is what I'm doing. I hope it works well." You know, four or five years later, I had no idea where it would take me and what it would do. It's just been a really amazing accident. The last few years have just, they've been so up and down. I've done so much, and now I'm back into working full time. From my blog, I've learned so much, and I'm now I'm a full-time social media manager, and I'm currently running over 45 social media accounts. It's a massive job. It's in the travel industry. I get to write about food, drink, travel all day. It's my dream job. 5-6 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. It's just, you know, how things have turned around.
So what was the job you were doing at the time?
So I worked in social media, and I got made redundant. So with my redundancy money, I decided to try and be my own boss. That was the plan. That was something that I really wanted to try. So I took my supper club, which was called the Secluded Tea Party, and my hostess name was Miss Soufflé, mainly for safety. I didn't want people to know my real name at the time. And I just decided to give it a go full time. So I did a lot of afternoon tea pop-ups. I did private catering, so I did a lot of baby showers and hen parties, birthday parties, and it really took off. I started teaching afternoon tea baking lessons in people's homes. I've always had a passion for baking. I did food tech at school, and I always, you know, when I was a brownie, I used to love the brownie cookbook. I always enjoyed baking, so it just felt natural. And afternoon tea is just so beautiful and so easy to write about and enjoy. So, and for the social element as well, afternoon tea, especially as a supper club, is a great way for strangers to come and enjoy something, pass the food around, pour each other the tea. It's almost an icebreaker for people who don't know each other. So it just worked really well.
Were you involved in doing a tea at the Eat Cambridge, the first Eat Cambridge, hidden away in the back of the Guildhall? Because
that's right. That
I seem to remember you doing that.
We did all sorts of things. And a lot of them were vintage-inspired tea parties, but the rebel in me also wanted to do tea parties that had my stamp on them. So I used to do a lot of zombie tea parties and lots of gory themed tea parties. So I did Breaking Bad themed parties. Mm-hmm. I did a Tarantino inspired tea party. I did all sorts of different weird things, and it worked really well because it just got different people interested in the pop-up scene. So I've really dabbled.
Tell me a little bit more about your blog and the elements of your blog at the moment.
So at the moment, my blog has, I mean, it's really bloomed. It started as an afternoon tea blog, blogging about my events, and then it kind of went naturally from there. I reviewed a lot of afternoon tea venues because people wanted to know where was my favourite afternoon tea, so it naturally became a review blog. And then from afternoon tea reviews, it graduated into, you know, visiting hotels for afternoon tea. I was then going for spa breaks. So there's a lot of spa reviews there as well. And then from that, travel. So it's taken a good few years for it to develop that way, but I think it works.
Would you say a commercial blog? So in other words, do you get paid for going for afternoon tea or a spa break? Sounds ideal.
Yeah. No, I've always kept it that way because there are a lot of places that do afternoon tea not very well, should I say. Oh. And I've always been of the opinion, if you've got nothing to say, that nothing nice to say, say nothing at all. So if it's not on the blog, then I haven't enjoyed it, or I haven't been. I like to pay for my own afternoon tea. I just think it's a more genuine review. Sometimes I have been offered the odd afternoon tea and I haven't turned it down. I have done it, but I would always declare it. Never monetized the blog. Natural progression for me was a lot of startups and food companies asking me for help on social media, blogging advice, So I set up a sister site called Stir Up Media, which was to help mainly food based clients with their social media and blogging. So that's how I've made my money over the last few years.
So that you already had the expertise in social media, you then developed your own company, and now work-wise you're running, I gather, a lot of social media accounts. Yes,
I mean Miss Soufflé is my brand in itself. It started as a secluded tea party and Miss Soufflé just stuck. I mean, it was a hostess named Hide Behind, but it's actually the brand that grew. I rebranded as MissSoufflé.com because that's how everyone knew me. So that's, you know, building that brand has sort of made people see that it's worked and they want to know how to do it. So that's how I've helped. I mean, as it's sort of gone on, Stir Up Media has helped. I've worked with Hot Point and I've done a lot of stuff for the BBC Good Food Show as well. And we did a lot of live tweeting whilst we were at the BBC Good Food Show. So with demo kitchens, a lot of the chefs, you know, they're cooking things, so we're doing a lot of live tweets whilst they're there doing it. So it's been really, really interesting.
Mm. Was there anything that you found difficult about the blog, particularly when you started?
Yes, I think the most difficult thing was actually balancing the blog with work and a social life as well. That was my main issue. And also just what to say. I always worried that I wasn't writing the right thing or I wasn't a natural writer. The best advice that was ever given to me was Tim Hayward, who now owns Fitzbillies, co-owns Fitzbillies. And he always said to me, you should write as you talk to a friend in the pub. That was great advice. When I wrote a blog, I'd literally stand there and talk to myself whilst I was writing it. And what I would say to myself is what I would write. And that's the way I've always blogged, the way I've always written.
So you didn't do any journalism courses or blogging courses?
No, nothing like that. I hosted a blog fest event once as one of my tea parties. And I literally invited a panel of blogging, writing, photographic experts to come along and help people who wanted to learn how to blog more. I found it probably just as useful as everyone else in that room did. It was really, really interesting. And that really got me into networking and make sure I surround myself with people who are interested, not just in food, but in social media, in blogging, because there's just so much you can learn from other people. Mm. So
things like the Grub Club now perhaps have taken on some of that role of networking as a food networking in the Cambridge area.
Yeah.
Has blogging brought you amazing opportunities or experiences?
Because I've built up an expertise in afternoon tea and the etiquette of afternoon tea, I've been invited to do a lot of TV work. So I filmed with Nigel Slater. I've been on the BBC One show. I've filmed for BBC's Escape to the Country. I've filmed with Alan Titchmarsh. I've done some very bizarre, random things, and it's just been really good fun. I've had recipes printed in baking books. You know, the list goes on. It's just been really good fun.
And this is all as a result, really, of your blog, or you going actively to seek these people?
Yeah, I think most of the TV and the radio appearances have been people coming to me, and I guess, you know, nobody should undervalue what they do and what they can offer. But, you know, they want me for my expertise, and that's what I've built up. So it's important to learn and be able to teach other people.
What has surprised you most about blogging?
The things that happen from it, what, you know, saying yes to something, what it can actually do to your life, or how it can, you know, make things really interesting. I said yes to using Rodder's clotted cream at my tea party events, and then that led to going down to their headquarters and having a VIP tour. Nobody else has had this tour, so it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Only the Prime Minister has been behind the scenes, and I've seen everything, all their secrets, which some of them I'm not allowed to divulge. And my family have sat with us around a table with Mr. Rogers himself, and he's read them a bedtime story. I mean, you know, that's just from saying yes to using a cream at my tea parties. Just
what have been your most popular posts?
My most popular posts have been things like how-tos, so how to host a royal tea party. I have a big American following, and they love to know how to put on a good English afternoon tea. So how to make a cucumber sandwich, the great scone debate, so jam versus cream, what goes first. Those are my most popular posts.
What about your personal favourite?
My personal favourite is the not-so-glamorous side of afternoon tea, all the dirty work that no one sees behind closed doors. And I'm sure a lot of, you know, restaurateurs and coffee shop owners will laugh and know just how dirty it can be. And people, you know, they think it's so glamorous and...
And that was Jo Christie talking with Sue Bailey. And Jo may do a few pop-ups this year, by the way. Keep an eye on her tweets at Miss Sue Flay to find out. And on the subject of tweeting... And here's the latest food tweets from the city. Keiriko Tapas will be at the Architect, 43 Castle Hill, with tapas on the 23rd and the 24th of February. Book at Eventbrite. The Gog Farm Shop has oxtail stew on at the moment. On the 22nd of February, the Cambridge Brew House has a launch of a new gluten-free pale ale. And to celebrate, there's a gluten-free supper club, a three-course set menu, four gluten-free beers, and a beer talk from their head brewer. That's £30 per ticket, and you can book at the pub, which is in King Street. And I must mention a wonderful-sounding cake at afternoon teas this weekend. Almond sponge with roasted rhubarb and cardamom buttercream. And I went along to get some yesterday, only to find that it's not ready until today. So I was very distressed. And just one more tweet. Tina Roche from Cambridge Cookery School mentioned not using a garlic press. Those of you who follow Tim Hayward might have noticed he tweeted a few minutes ago saying he's not found anyone in Cambridge who'll admit to even owning one.
Now, a new cafe has opened up on Mill Road, right down the end, in fact, on the Brookfield site. And it's the home of the loveliest soup I've ever had in my life.
Very good, this is. Yes. I like coming here. This is very good.
The Edge Cafe. It's at the edge of Mill Road. Did you know about it?
That's because we started quietly. Test the waters to see how it went. Established the cafe, and we've done that. We had our official launch 2 weeks ago.
This is a bright, sunny, well, gorgeous cafe, really, and it's got a unique focus in Cambridge.
My name is Susie Tolbert. I work for Cambridgeshire County Council, and I'm the drug and alcohol strategic lead. The message to us coming back was that people were leaving our specialist services, but then it felt a bit like a cliff edge.
I've had this safety net all this time, and now it's gone.
People didn't really know where the support mechanisms were in place unless they were already accessing places like NA and AA.
They felt it was important to build a local base where people could come, support each other through recovery and gain confidence.
And that's where we came up with the idea of a recovery cafe.
Walking by and the wonderful smell of the bacon caught my nose.
I've had lovely halloumi and beetroot ciabatta, lovely frittatas that you'll just see on the counter and think, I want that.
And I've been meaning to come to the edge. I've actually passed by here several times and I keep reminding myself to, oh, I need to stop in that little cafe and at least have a coffee.
I'm sorry I'm stuffing my face right now.
Sometimes I'll have grain sauce, but it's not compulsory.
A bacon, an egg, wrap, and a piece of banana cake and a pot of tea.
The staff mix is great. Nothing's too much trouble. The food's really good. So it all comes together.
Yes, I really do like it here.
No, I'm happy to talk about it.
My name's Donna James. I am the volunteer coordinator for the Edge Cafe. What's unique about this is the recovery element. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I completely isolated myself. I hid drinking. It came to a point where I ended up being arrested. Waking up in a police cell, realising, why am I here? I'd been drinking for 2 years, daily, and it had spiralled out of control, and I was on the bottom. And the first thing that I had to do was admit I was an alcoholic, because I kept denying it. And that was the first step of me becoming the person I am today. I've completely changed I never used to leave the house. I used to live in the garden. If I went out, I would have a lot of anxiety. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was craving alcohol to dampen down the feelings that I had. I couldn't cope with how I was feeling inside. So I took the step fixing myself, which was not an easy process. And I started it with the help of Inclusion.
Inclusion?
Yes, it's a place where you can go if you have problems.
And slowly we worked through everything.
Oh, I didn't want to go to start with, but people, when they go, they're so glad they've been.
I realised that my confidence levels had increased and I needed something to do.
Don't be worried about it and don't be frightened. Just come and do it. Yeah.
And I found out about the Edge Cafe project.
People have helped me and I appreciate it. If I can help anybody, I will.
It is, for me, a home from home, which is why I'm here so much. And know that you're not on your own, that there is always someone here to help. It's all right. You can see a future where there, at that time, there is none. And that's what I want to pass on to anybody that comes in here looking for help. I will not tell them what to do, but I will be an ear for them.
It's the little touches in the room which really make it. Little herbs on the windowsill for the cooking, to the nice little vintage coat stand, to then the local art. Just adds a real sense of community.
People are just walking in the door and offering to do stuff, which is amazing. I think we've really hit a nerve.
Do you know him, dear?
Oh, yeah, that's Andy.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. I just love my job.
Andy Ahmad Cook is the recovery coordinator.
It's only my second week in post. Previously, I was volunteering. But I can't imagine anything more exciting than me. I'm very passionate about the world of recovery. I'm in recovery myself. So, yeah, the whole thing, it's just fun to come here.
Can you imagine if you were coming from the environment like I have before, from like the hospital, to coming into here, it doesn't have that clinical feel.
It's a place where people can come, talk, have a hug, whatever it is. We're here, and I just love the feel. I just love the feel of it. It's a lovely place to come, to eat or to work.
The fresh fruit's really yummy.
We have Fair Share every Friday from Tesco's Newmarket Road. They give us items which would otherwise be thrown out.
Everybody who comes in here can have some of them. But I usually come for Friday and have a look.
Yeah, brilliant idea.
Mm.
It doesn't matter who you are, you're entitled to come in, pick your stuff and leave.
And today I can see there's plenty of bread, cucumbers, lots of punnets of blueberries, oranges, everything, really. Yeah.
Sarah's fantastic at Fair Share. This is her baby.
Sarah.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you met her?
I met her briefly, yes.
She's a lovely lady.
She loves it. So do we.
I know Sarah, who manages the cafe. She's very enthusiastic about good food. And you can see it and you can taste it.
And here we are on a Friday afternoon now. It is the afternoon, isn't it?
Pause, a bit of respite, a bit of respite. Because yeah, sure. I think a repeat of earlier is sure to happen. I like all the staff to cook, and I want them all to be able to make a cake, so I'm not so bothered if something goes wrong. It's still yummy because it's all homemade, so we often perhaps put something that looks a bit, you know, but I know it's going to be yummy and I'll sell it for less. And then, you know, we experiment a lot. Like, out of my sandwiches, I can't believe beetroot, halloumi and spinach with sweet chilli sauce just walks out the door. When I was at school, instead of pop stars up on my wall, I had pictures of vegetables and weird things like that.
You didn't. I did.
Seriously. It's exciting because you've got to fit it all in, but obviously customers come first, and that's what it's a bit of today. Little snippets of making a carrot cake because we have lots of vegans come on a Saturday.
And why's that?
They've got the word out that we serve some nice vegan things. I want to be able to feed everybody. So, of course, give yummy stuff to people in recovery who, you know, get their taste buds back. But also gluten-free or vegetarians, but also veganism or whatever it is taking off.
It's hard to find reasonably priced veggie breakfast in Cambridge that's open early enough. Yeah, so great.
So there's always something vegan, always something gluten-free, and there's obviously vegetarian.
And the other one, I know, but...
Dawn.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm not very good with names.
Live and learn. I spent 37 years out there.
I'm sober. What price is that?
Just to be clear, though, like, when you say 37 years out there, you mean 37 years?
Yeah, drinking, drugging. You know, I'm in awe of other people, and the things I have to learn is it's OK to ask for help. It's like a disease of isolation and shame, I believe, for me. So, yeah, connecting with sober people, people that support me through those early days and now, it's like life is good. Life is OK, you know? Everyday miracle.
Now you're here with Sarah and Donna.
I'm here with Sarah and Donna. Great support. Challenge. Every day's a challenge. Yeah, hot in the kitchen. It's all good. Then it's great to be part of that. Yeah.
And it's really important that, you know, people are given the opportunities to build self-esteem and confidence and use it to go back out into local community to gain paid employment somewhere else or to go back to college to fulfil educational requirements. And it's really important that people are given the opportunity to be able to do that.
This is the Edge Cafe on Mill Road, where I've been talking to Matt. It's been very interesting and I really enjoyed it. Yes.
It's brand new. I really wish them success. And I think there's a great deal of care put into the food. And I wish them luck.
And it's great for us all to stand together and that there is no them and us, it's we.
It's not in your face absolutely at all. It's just an ordinary cafe that will benefit for people that need a little bit of help.
Very nice. Compliments to the chefess.
You'll be coming back.
Yes, I think I'll give it a whirl. Yes, yes. Just to make sure just it wasn't a one-off. Bless you.
Thanks to everybody who spoke to me on that day. There's so much going on at that cafe, you know. It's got a lively arts programme, a night of soul food, that's reading and poetry. There's mindfulness and meditation group, a knitting group, Pilates classes. They got their first clothes swap next Saturday, and they host a monthly art exhibition featuring local talent. And their food is great. Everything is made on site, including chutneys, soups, fresh cookies, pies and cakes. That's the Edge Cafe on 351 Mill Road. It's open 8 till 4 on the weekdays and 9 till 4 on Saturdays. And their website, this is all one word, theedgecafecambridge.org.
Well, it sounds really good, I must say.
It was, yeah.
Right, time for some Olio news. Olio is an app that you can download and it tells you where you can get free food. And it's not just for people who may not be able to afford food, it's for everybody because there's a real problem with food going to waste that doesn't need to. And Olio in Cambridge, there's been some really good things on recently. Most of them have gone now, but still there are packs of boiled eggs. These are all from Great Shelford, by the way. There's cheese and chive sandwich fillers. There's coleslaw, there's paprika egg salad, and there's cucumber salad. They're all free and they're all available right now from Great Shelford. So if you download the Olio app, it will tell you how to get them.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Well, it's been a cold winter, lots of frosty mornings, but it is warming up and time to think about venturing out into the allotment or vegetable garden. Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments is already there. And in his first feature of the year, he talks about the lifeblood of the growing vegetable and how to produce your own. Dave, you're standing by a new compost heap by the look of it.
Yes, this is the work of the winter to construct a large new compost area. So it's about a metre and a half by 2 metres, and there are two such bays made out of old fence panels and pallets. And so what I'm trying to do is put all my compostable material in one place so that it heats up and perhaps breaks down a little bit quicker, makes it a bit easier to manage. And as you notice, we've already got there's flies above it. I mean, it's been very cold recently, but that's just one manifestation of the ecosystem, all the biodiversity in there. Everybody eating the little bits of vegetable matter and starting to break it down, and you know, ultimately turn this old plant material into compost which will feed the next plants.
Well, it's amazing to see the flies after such a cold winter.
Doesn't take long for them to appear, does it?
It doesn't, no, and it also shows how warm the compost seat must be already, I suppose.
Yes, that's right. I've got a metal probe somewhere. Maybe I've lost it, but I like to stick that in. I can pull it out from time to time and just feel how warm it is. Of course, it must be surely every gardener's ambition to have a compost heap set on fire. It apparently has happened.
Well, it's got so hot.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit 451.
Yeah. When we get deliveries of the black stuff, you know, the composted curbside waste that you can pick up from Amy Sesper in their recycling plant at Waterbeach, that's really hot. In the middle of piles of that, it's turned to a white, ashy material. So there's obviously some form of combustion going on there, but as to the temperatures, you can certainly feel it's warm to the touch.
This is made up of mostly leaf matter, isn't it? So how long would that take to
it's all
down?
Sorts actually. There's
few twigs in there.
There's
actually
a lot of cut up twigs, so yeah. When I do the pruning, so sometimes I cut up quite a lot of it and put it in here. There's also some wood chip which I got from a tree surgeon, so that's a lot, and that's Leylandii. Wood chip is this almost always Leylandii.
Yeah.
But that'll break down over time. They've chipped it quite fine, and then in the lower layers there'll be grass clippings from last summer, which I saved and then added to it. There's been layers of wood ash from the wood-burning stove go in. So there's all sorts. I mean, it's anything that was once living plant material can go in. Don't put too much cooked food in, really. You shouldn't really put any in. A tiny amount you probably get away with, but you certainly really don't want to attract rats.
Yeah.
That's a bad idea. So clean plant material.
So this is quite a large compost heap by, say, garden standards at any rate, and so it will generate more heat. So, I mean, can you hazard a guess as to how long it will take before it starts producing something that you can then put back on the soil?
Probably just 6 months or so that there'll be something useful at the bottom, but of course that's difficult to get at. So being a lazy gardener, I'll probably leave this for a couple of years and then turn it into the next. I mentioned there are two bays, so I'll turn one bay into the next bay. To rotate it, get more air in, that'll really help speed it up. Maybe mix in a bit more fine material. If it's dry, I'll mix in some grass clippings, for example, just to even out the balance of carbon and nitrogen.
And it's not necessary to put some sort of cover over it, because when it rains, it's going to cool it all down, isn't it? That's just not necessary, presumably, if you're prepared to wait for 2 years at any rate.
If you think it's too wet, then cover it, because that's going to obviously shed some of the rain off and also keep it a little bit warmer. So it's not a bad idea. But I think you just have, like all gardening, you just have to observe and see what happens in your particular situation. Not too wet, not too dry. Some compost heaps need watering.
yeah.
Right, so what would... Oh, yeah, so we just throw in this... so this is from the bucket that I keep by my kitchen, so this is kitchen waste, so... This is a mature compost heap, so this has been here for at least 4 years. So lazy gardener wins here by basically building a good compost heap of a good mixture of greens and browns, good carbon to nitrogen ratio. Most stuff reasonably well chopped up and just left it. Yeah. You know, the books will tell you to turn your compost once a year, make it rot down quicker. Well, that's fine if you've got time and energy to do that, but if you just leave it, it will compost down. And so if we dig into this, I've taken one side. I've got a sort of a meter cube bin made out of pallets here, so I've taken one pallet off the side to expose it so I can dig it out and get it into the barrow. So just dig in.
Well, it's really dark.
Yep.
And as you say, very well rotted down indeed.
Yeah. This is good. If you break, although there's a worm for a start. That's a red worm, sort of smaller than the earthworm. Oh, I saw a young centipede there. And there's wood lice. So there's lots of wildlife in here. And if we, look, it's just breaking up. It's crumbly. It's moist, but it still crumbles. So. This is pretty good. Though there's a lump of something that hasn't rotted down, so that's a piece of...
And it's all free.
It's free! That's right, I know, it's amazing, isn't it? So there you go, never throw any clean biomass away. Compost it all. Get your hair, I'm going to get a haircut, bring it back, put it in. Absolutely, you know, don't let any of this stuff go to waste. Cardboard, you can get the sellotape and the staples off it.
use that, because that's obviously made of trees. Kitchen scraps, grass clippings. I get my neighbours to bring their grass clippings round. I mean, they know that it's... They put it in the green bin, but it's a shame for it to go all the way to Water Beach and then come all the way back in, isn't it? We can compost it here. And then you can use the compost to feed the plants or to act as a mulch as well. So to keep the moisture in the soil as well as feeding it. It's got loads of uses, but you can never make enough.
Mm.
So I say, if you're planning a garden, always figure out where you're going to put a compost bin and just aim to make as much as you possibly can. So we'll take some of this over to a bed where I'm going to sow my first parsnip. It's a little bit early to sow the parsnips yet. We could risk it, but I'm going to leave it a week or two. But what I'm going to do now is put some compost on that bed. The advantage of doing that in advance of sowing is that it means that the weed seeds that are inevitably in the compost will have a chance to germinate, and then I can hoe them off and have a clean start when we actually put the parsnip seed in. So this bed's going to have parsnips in. You can see I've already hoed it off, so there's not too many weeds in there. But what I'm going to do is just add a barrel load of compost into the bed. Then I'll spread that out with a rake. Look at that. Spread that out with a rake, and then hoe it off in a couple of weeks when the weeds have had a chance to germinate. And hopefully that'll be what, 1st of March, time to get the parsnips in. Parsnips have a fairly long growing season, so it's something you want to aim to sow fairly early, as soon as the weather permits.
Mm.
As regards sowing, it's always tempting to start as soon as the weather warms up, but don't forget that most veg seed doesn't germinate below about 8 degrees daytime, consistent daytime temperatures, so don't go wasting too much seed. One thing you can do with salads, early carrots, the parsnips, maybe some spring onions, maybe spring cabbage, spinach, you could sow under a cloche. So if you're prepared to put in a little bit of effort to get your crop off to a head start, then sow as normal outdoors and then build something made of polythene or glass that's going to let the light through but give it an extra degree or two of temperature protection, and you might just get away to an early start. That's only if you're keen.
Yes, good advice though, right.
And another way of increasing productivity, this time of fruit bushes and trees, is by pruning.
So this is an established blackcurrant bush, which needs a bit of pruning. Blackcurrants grow on older wood. They grow on wood which is 2 or 3 or 4 years old. So that means that on old wood that's like 4 or more years old, we're probably looking at taking that out. The point being that encourages fresh new growth, so that in 2 years' time we start getting a new flush of fruit. The other rule about pruning in general is when a branch is damaged or diseased, we take it out anyway. So when you're pruning, the first thing to do is look for damaged, disease, and also crossing branches where they're going to rub against each other.
And what sort of damage would you expect to find?
Well, here's an example. So this branch, that's 4 year old wood anyway. So
and
just by the colour of it.
And also its thickness.
The colour and thickness. Certainly 3 years, maybe 4.
Yeah.
But also it's got a hole quite near the base, and that's going to rot in there. It will already be rotting. And the other thing, this branch is actually lying quite low. I'd much rather have more upright branches. So I'm going to take this out as close as I can to the base with a clean cut using my loppers. Yeah. So at least 10 branches remaining. And because we're looking to remove any wood that's more than 4 years old, logically we should say, well, we should probably be removing about a quarter of the branches overall. Sort of makes sense, doesn't it? So there's another old branch which I'm going to take out, which is this one. It's also fairly low, so it's a good one to remove. So I'm just going to get as close as I can to the branch without damaging its neighbours and take it out with a nice clean cut. And let's remember that the reason we're pruning at this time of year is because it's cold, so the sap is down, so the wound's not going to bleed.
and there's not too much chance of disease getting in. And that's all. I'm not going to be pruning the tips of these branches at all, because that's all buds which is going to produce fruit. The other thing to check for is if there's any damaged or broken ones, which I would prune off to a clean cut. But I can't see any. We're trying to again first identify any crossing branches which are going to rub and potentially cause disease. We're trying to allow plenty of space for light and air to get into the middle of the tree, prevent disease. And
yeah,
there you go. There's a small crossing branch, so that comes off. There's a lot of new growth which is pointing straight upwards. That's not going to fruit particularly well. Horizontal branches produce a lot more fruit. So what I'm going to do is take out about half of the new growth on some of these stems. So the weaker stems I'll prune back a lot more to an outward facing bud. There's a fruiting bud, so I'll leave that one on.
And you identify fruiting buds because they're bigger than the leaf buds.
Yeah.
And that was Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments. And if there's a topic you'd like Dave to cover in a future programme, please let us know. You can email us, flavour@cambridge105.co.uk.
So are you tempted to grow your own, Matt?
Well, doing a radio show is quite tricky and time-consuming, but if I was going to grow something, it would be veg. I'd go for tomatoes because of the taste and the smell. I'd go for lettuces because they're supposed to be, well, notoriously easy to grow. Mm. And I'd also go for beans, particularly the beans from Seedy Sunday when I went there in 2012. And there's so many rare breeds that you can buy for relatively little money and have growing in your garden, and styles and sights that I haven't seen since I was a kid. So I think that'd be brilliant.
Sounds like you might do it one day.
And onto the news now. Here's Emma O'Hanlon with the University Food and Drink News to start with.
The Tea Society will hold a free tea tasting with the founders of Marilyn, a London-based startup, tomorrow afternoon, Sunday, February 15th. As usual, the meeting will take place in the Bowett Room of Queen's College from 2:15 to 4:15. On another note, the Society will be holding elections for next year's President, Treasurer and Secretary on Sunday the 26th, so if you're interested in a committee position, do go along to that with a manifesto. Clare College Colonies Blythe Room will host an intercultural feast this Sunday evening, offering the opportunity to socialise in different languages and sample a selection of international food and drink. The evening is split into two halves, 7:30 to 9 p.m. and 9 to 10:30 p.m. The tickets at £8 each will get you into one of these sessions, as well as providing you with 8 tokens to redeem food. Additional tokens can be purchased should you want to. The Arab, Belgian, European, French, German, Italian, Polish and Russian societies will all be represented. Booking is now open and it's a popular event, so get yours through the Facebook event or on Eventbrite. The Cambridge University Wine Society has two more tastings coming up. As usual, the tickets go on sale at 6 p.m. 4 days before the event, and both take place at 9 p.m. in Upper Hall at Peterhouse. The first, for which tickets will be released tonight, is a tasting of English still wines with the Furley Estate in Dorset on Wednesday, February 22nd. The second is on Wednesday, March 1st, of Chateau Lagrange wines from Saint-Julien. Finally, the Islamic Society is holding an interfaith dinner tonight with talks throughout the night on the position of religion in a postmodern society. 7 p.m. in St Paul's Church. The tickets are just £4.50 for a three-course meal with a great selection of Pakistani food on offer.
That's amazing. £4.50 for a three-course meal. Are you going?
Hopefully.
OK, on to the city news now, and we'll start as usual with jobs. La Margarita on Magdalen Street by Castle Hill, they're currently recruiting bar and floor staff. Applicants must be able to work both positions, and if you're interested, just telephone Cambridge 315 232.
There's a new bakery opened by the station opposite the bus stops. It's called Zio Mario, and they're looking for an experienced barista. You need to be capable of managing orders and stock rotation and rota scheduling. Full-time is preferred. Phone 07825 826 290. That's 07825 826 290 for information.
Aromi is also looking for full or part-time baristas. They'd like a CV and covering letter. Drop it into their coffee shop on Bennett Street.
And the Kingston Arms in Kingston Street needs a second chef. pay is £9 an hour. There's a 40 to 45 hour week with some weekends and split shifts. Pop into the pub for more details.
A section chef is also needed at Smokeworks in Free School Lane. Address your CV to Executive Head Chef Vladimir Hromek, H-R-O-M-E-K, and just drop it in.
Rocker's Steakhouse need full-time or part-time waiting staff and kitchen staff. They are at 52 Mill Road and also at Cambridge Leisure Park. Drop in your CV.
And we'll have more jobs next time. Good luck if you're applying for one, and please say that you heard about it here on Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Right, some really good and impressive news from Food Park now. A great idea. They're launching a new evening pitch with the Blue Moon Pub next month on Thursday the 9th of March and then every first Thursday of the month thereafter. Food Park will be providing street food at the pub from 6 till 10, and in a tap takeover, breweries will take over the pub's taps and serve up some exciting and innovative beers. The opening tap takeover has Thornbridge Brewery on the taps and Gorilla Kitchen on the tarmac. The first event of 2017 will be showcasing a selection of 10 beers from Thornbridge. You can go along and try them one by one at your leisure, or sign up for the official tasting with Thornbridge's own expert beer tasters for £15 per person, and you do that at the Blue Moon in advance. Gorilla Kitchen's bow, ribs and sides should be a really good match too. It all sounds wonderful to me.
News from K Rico Tapas. Estefania is hosting the first of a series of tapas nights with a sherry and tapas matching evening at 7pm on 21st February in the Cherry Hinton Road branch of the Cambridge Wine Merchants. Sherry is one of those drinks which pairs superbly with food, and on this evening there will be five different sherries to go with the five tapas. The dishes are popular in Spain but not terribly well known in the UK. There will be asparagus cake, mussels with cauliflower cream, brandada, salted cod with milk, goat with ajo blanco, and a tapa dessert. The tasting costs £32.50 per person, inclusive of five sherries and five tapas. Bookings are required, so call the Cambridge Wine Merchants, Cherry Hinton Road, on Cambridge 214 548.
Right, and that's all that we have time for today. If you've missed bits or just want to hear the whole thing all over again, 7 o'clock tomorrow morning and podcast early next week.
Remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm. Or you can follow us on Twitter at Flavour105. And of course, you can also follow Cambridge 105 Radio itself at Cambridge 105. And the music excerpts today were Bobby Day with Rockin' Robin and The Fall with Garden. So, Flavour will be back on the 3rd of March. And until then,
bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.